from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians took to the streets over the weekend to protest President Viktor Yanukovych's refusal to sign a trade agreement with the European Union. For this economically embattled country, it signaled an alarming move away from the West, a dangerous capitulation to Russia. This hour on Point, spheres of influence and the fate of Ukraine. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you make of the hundreds of thousands of protesters who took to the streets over the weekend in Ukraine? Is this the old East-West conflict again? Something else? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Big, big demonstrations over the weekend. On Monday in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, over 100,000 protesters still clashed with police forces near Independence Square outside the presidential administration building. Police used riot grenades as they retreated. Big, big crowds and fierce conflict at times over the weekend. Joining me now from Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, is Sergei Loyko, Moscow correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, now in Kiev. Sergei, thank you very much for being with us. What's the situation in the streets in Kiev today?
Things are pretty quiet, and it looks like a stalemate with a potential for President Yanukovych to lick his wounds and try to get the upper hand. So the opposition lost the initiative. They kind of failed, in my opinion, to capitalize on Sunday's huge, at least 300,000 strong rally.
There was a vote yesterday in Parliament, a vote on tossing out the government, I guess. That failed.
Yeah, that was the first stage in the opposition plan to unseat the president and the government. And they appeared not to have prepared for it thoroughly. They counted on the communists to help them, and they counted on more defectors from the ruling party faction in parliament. But in fact, only one or two persons defected from the ruling from Yanukovych's party in parliament, and only one of them voted for the resignation of the government. And the communists, as often happens in history, betrayed them.
Remind us of the Yanukovych decision, the Ukrainian leader's decision, that so jolted at least part of Ukraine's population and brought them out into the streets. What was his decision vis-a-vis the European Union?
Ukraine has been preparing for the association and for signing the association and trade agreement with European Union for quite a while. And suddenly, last week, actually on Friday, although there have been several, there had been several warning shots before.
Yeah.
Yanukovych flew to Vilnius, but refrained from signing the agreement, saying that Ukraine is not ready economically, which kind of deepened even further the split of the biggest in Europe outside Russia, 45 million strong country, along political, social, demographic, geographic, and religious lines.
What was the pressure from Moscow on the other side? Vladimir Putin appeared very determined to keep Ukraine in Russia's customs union, they're calling it, a Eurasian union. He envisions of former Soviet countries. What was the pressure brought to bear from the Russian side?
Experts on all sides say that Russia, in the weeks preceding the signing or not signing of the fateful agreement, applied unprecedented, fierce pressure on Ukraine. Ukraine is bound, and Yanukovych admitted that himself, by the enslaving gas supply agreement, which was signed by the former prime minister and the Orange Revolution princess, Yulia Tymoshenko, in 2009, mm-hmm. in the middle of the economic crisis in Europe. Tymoshenko was preparing for the presidential elections in 2010, and she gambled and lost. And actually, the agreement is the backbone of all the problems on both sides, because the agreement provides for Ukraine to buy 50 billion cubic meters of natural gas every year and pay for 50 billion cubic meters of natural gas. And Ukraine has been using in the last 2 years only 17 billion cubic meters of gas annually, but had to pay the whole price. Well, it's just outrageous. It's the contract has been draining Ukraine economy bare, and on the other hand, Russia is Ukraine's biggest economic partner in Europe, some regions, especially in the east, in the industrial pro-Yanukovych east of Ukraine, for their supplies, for 80% of their supplies, and for most of the market for its produce, depend on Russia.
That's tremendous leverage. You said at the top of our conversation that the opposition, after its loss yesterday, appears that it may have lost. Is this really over after the huge demonstrations we saw over the weekend, or does this go on, this what looked like some kind of popular uprising?
It's going on. It's going on, and we are right now in the middle of a trench war where no shots, luckily, have not been fired yet. But both sides entrenched themselves deeply. Yanukovych on a visit to China, and the opposition in the main square of the city. And the opposition demonstrated at least two times in the last 2 weeks that it has the potential of swelling the ranks of the protesters and demonstrators in town to hundreds of thousands of people, which by European revolutions standards is a critical mass.
That was a very, very large crowd indeed, and more than once with all those blue and yellow flags. That, of course, the flag of the Ukraine, but also, as it turns out, the colors of the European Union on huge display there in the middle of Kiev, where protesters remain
even
now.
Yeah, and they're also blue with yellow stars in
yes.
them, Tom. And to add to the confusion, the flags of Yanukovych's Party of Regions are blue and white.
So, Ukraine in turmoil in recent days. We're looking into what exactly is unfolding there and where it may go. Sergei Loiko with the Los Angeles Times with us today from Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. Sergei, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
On Monday, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych called for peace in the streets. Here translated by Euronews.
As for the people who came out to the rallies, any show of public will is always confirmed by everybody's freedom and right to speak their mind. It is important that these rallies have a peaceful character. It doesn't matter if it's the representatives of the government, law enforcement agencies, or the participants of the rallies. All must respect the law.
There was plenty of blood and baton out there for a while, and the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, was not putting such a kind of a calm cast on things. Here he was at a Monday press conference in nearby Armenia, saying there was more going on in Kiev than honest unrest.
As I see it, what's going on in Kiev has little to do with Ukraine's relations with the EU. What's going on doesn't look like a revolution, but a well-planned action. We can see well-prepared and organized militant groups. The opposition is either not always in control of what's going on, or is a political shroud for extremist actions.
Vladimir Putin putting a dark cast on what was going on in Kiev. With me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Serhii Plokhii, professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard, author of Ukraine and Russia and the Origin of the Slavic Nations. Serhii Plokhii, thank you very much for being with us. What do you see going on in Ukraine? What's happening here?
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on this program. Well, it's a multi-layer cake, and the two main layers are, of course, geopolitics, and another one is the political process in Ukraine, per se. And in geopolitical terms, for me as a historian, what happened reminded me about Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, when the authorities changed the course abruptly, the foreign policy course. And the major difference is that, of course, back then in the Stalin Soviet Union, there was no public opinion per se. The people certainly didn't have their voice.
Yeah.
But in Ukraine, we all could see that actually people care, people want to be consulted, and they say no to this kind of a backroom deals behind the back of opposition, behind the back of the political class. And they went to the streets to protest against that, and also to defend their future. And people on the streets, they see their future in Europe in terms of living in a country that shares European values when it comes to democracy.
We have just a couple of seconds before the break. Is that path still open at this as we speak?
I believe it is open.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the battle over Ukraine in this hour and what Ukrainians want, what they may get. There behind us the sound on Sunday night of crowds of protesters filling Independence Square in Kiev, clashing there with riot police, huge numbers, and a lot of conflict in that standoff. Much of it still goes on, but a vote lost yesterday to take down the government in the Ukrainian parliament. Here's the sound of John Kerry talking about this at NATO headquarters in Brussels yesterday.
We urge the Ukrainian government to listen to the voices of its people who want to live in freedom and in opportunity and prosperity. And we urge all sides to conduct themselves peacefully. Violence has no place in a modern European state.
But they're still in the streets. Here was a group of peaceful protesters, this was Monday, calling for the resignation of Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Serhiy Plokhiy joins us. He's a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard and with us on the line right now from Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, Alisa Rubin. She's an organizer in these protests, International Secretary for the Democratic Alliance, one of Ukraine's opposition parties. Alisa Rubin, thank you very much for joining us. Does the protest go on?
Hello, Tom. Thank you a lot for inviting me. I'm live from Kiev from protest. The protests are still on and will continue, definitely.
What is your path at this point? The vote in parliament went against you yesterday. The government was not voted out of power. What are your options now?
Actually, when we first came out to the streets on the 21st of November, our main goal was to support the European choice of Ukrainian citizens when our government adopted the decision to stop negotiations with the EU. But after the Yanukovych didn't sign the agreement, and after the police used brutal force against peaceful protesters, against students, against journalists, now we are standing not only for the European choice, actually we are standing for our future, for Ukraine, because we realize if we will leave the streets now, if we will just go home and we'll take this situation, probably it will be like the death of democracy. Actually, we don't really see our future in this country anymore.
Alisa, when you say you want the European choice, what does that mean? What does it stand for to you? What does that entail? What do you want?
What do we want? We wanted the signature of this association agreement with the EU. We want European way of development of our country, which means European values, which means fight against corruption, which is everywhere in our country, which means the views of Europeans, not the customs union with Russia.
Why do you...
as I said, it's not only about... Yes.
Why do you think President Yanukovych has gone instead with the deal with Moscow? Why?
Just when government adopts some decision, they first think about some things which can apply personally to themselves, not to the country or to their people. So I think there are some personal reasons for Mr. Yanukovych to be closer to Russia and not to the EU.
Do you still have a real chance to achieve a closer relationship with the European Union, or is that now gone?
I believe yes, but now the main goal of this protest is resignation of Yanukovych.
He's in China. Do you think he's listening?
I hope his advisors and people who tell him are listening, but now we understand that it's not only about the choice of our foreign policy, it's the choice of our future. So first of all, we need to change this situation. We need to change the authorities. And then with the new people in power, we can closer to Europe or whatever we choose.
Alisa
first
Rubin,
of all, now we demand resignation of Yanukovych.
Alisa Rubin, please stay safe in the streets. And thank you very much for joining us today. Alisa Rubin there in the streets of Kiev. Serhiy Plokhiy joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Serhiy, how do you see the fundamental dynamic of what's playing out here? What's going on?
Well, this is the moment when the opposition forces are a little bit, they lost their way. The expectations were that by putting 300,000 or more people on the streets, the government would listen, that at least the Minister of Interior, who is certainly responsible for the brutal dispersal of the demonstration before that, would resign. It didn't happen. And the opposition certainly decided not to use force to take over, let's say, the presidential administration or the building of the parliament, so they're staying within the constitution. And now they try to figure out what to do next. My personal opinion that the government thinks in relatively long terms, in terms at least of elections of 2015, presidential elections, and the opposition has to think long term, or at least medium term as well.
But we see right away from the West, at least, maybe from the East as well, a sort of Cold War cast coming back around this. Like it's a tug of war. Here's the Ukraine. Will it join the East or join the West? Is that a realistic interpretation of what's going on here? I mean, Ukraine, after all, sits right underneath Russia. Can it really be separate from Russia? What's the choice that Ukrainians are making?
Well, Ukrainians since 2004, since the events of the Orange Revolution, found themselves in the situation between really two emerging blocs. One bloc is very, very clearly defined. It is NATO and European Union. In 2004-2005, Ukrainian government wanted Ukraine to join NATO and EU. It didn't work out. On the other hand, there is Russia Customs Union. And certainly from the point of view of Kremlin, having Ukraine as part of Customs Union, this is something extremely important. And this abrupt turn in Ukrainian foreign policy happened after consultations between the President Putin and President Yanukovych. We don't know what they discussed, what the promises or threats were made, but it's certainly these two things are really closely related.
The customs union, Ukraine has come into this now, along with Moldova and Georgia, deals that they've signed there. Russia has a bigger union in mind of former Soviet countries. Is this a trade union or something more than that, Serhiy?
Well, it is a trade union, but again, there is also very important in case of Ukraine an identity component. And Putin went on record more than once saying that he is talking about one people, Russians and Ukrainians. So many people in Kyiv are afraid that it starts with the customs union, but it can lead to some kind of a recreation of empire, maybe informal empire, but still Russia lead not only economic but also political and military union.
Serhiy Plokhiy, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation as well from Oxford, England, Gwendolyn Zassa. She's professor of politics, international relations at the University of Oxford, focused on post-communist transitions, the enlargement of the EU to the East, author of Europeanization and Regionalization in the EU's Enlargement to Central and Eastern Europe, and also Ethnicity and Territory in the Former Soviet Union. Gwen Zassa, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you see unfolding in these quite
fiery handful of days.
Yes, in many ways it seems as if Ukraine has come full circle exactly 9 years after the Orange Revolution. But I think there are also important differences. On the one hand, we see the similarities. The key actors are still around. Yanukovych, clearly the key actor at the moment on the side of the regime. Then the issue of Russia supporting or putting pressure on Ukraine in various ways. We see similar numbers of people out in the street. We're not entirely sure yet, again, about the exact breakdown of who is protesting. I think some patterns are beginning to emerge. Maybe we can talk about this in a little while. But then there are important differences, and clearly the incidence of violence, that's an important difference. Also, the issue in 2004 was the trigger was electoral fraud. So that's in many ways a much more concrete issue than the relationship with the EU or with the West, or a more general plea for the government and the president to resign. I think that increases the uncertainty surrounding some of these events now. And I think another important difference, and some of your other contributors have already touched on that, is that the political landscape looks a bit different. So the situation has changed from 2004. And the political opposition, the opposition parties in particular, are a bit different. And also the population at large has seen what happened with the Orange political opposition and how that coalition fell apart. So there's generally less trust in political parties and the political opposition. And that, I think, makes it even harder to see how what the next step could be and what the political alternative really is at the moment.
I mean, we should remind people that it was Yanukovych, who's the leader now, whose sort of fraud-tainted election back in 2004 was a major spark to the then Orange Revolution. A pro-Western government came into power in defiance of Moscow. Now, of course, Yanukovych back in power. In the United States, Gwen Zsa, it's easy to look at this and say, what's happening here? Is this the Cold War revived? Is this Western Europe versus Russia redux? Is that what's going on here? Is this a recreation of the Soviet Union through this trade bloc or more? Or is it more subtle now than that, Gwen?
I think it is more subtle, and I think personally that this Cold War rhetoric and also the rhetoric about a tug of war between the West and Russia over Ukraine is not particularly helpful, although that kind of rhetoric comes up every time we see events like these unfold in
Many
Ukraine.
Ukrainians use it, I must point out. I'm reading plenty of them, the Ukrainians, in the last few days. But anyway, what do you see there?
Yes, I think it's clearly a rhetorical device that can mobilize, and at the same time we should be careful, I think, looking at it from the outside. There have been several shifts in Ukrainian foreign policy, if that's what we start with. So the issue of a choice that Ukraine has, unfortunately or fortunately, it doesn't present itself quite as like that. And it will have to balance whatever happens, its location, its dependence on resources, as well as different aspirations of part of the population. So it's not as rapid or surprising a shift. What was surprising was that it came at the eve of this EU summit, and it seemed that the deal was going to go ahead and Yanukovych would sign it. So that was very abrupt. But the underlying issues of balancing different interests that a country of Ukraine's size, location and makeup has to face. They have been there before, and that's not going to go away, whoever is in power in Ukraine.
Serhii Plokhii, do you see a fundamental choice before Ukrainians about which direction, what kind of culture and politics they're going to associate with? Is there a fundamental choice? And if it was surprising to see them turn away from this European deal, what was behind that surprise? What drove that move?
Well, we just heard a person from the streets of Kyiv, and she said that it is a question of values. Mm-hmm. So it is more than geopolitical choice for the Ukrainians. You don't see any or maybe a lot of anti-Russian slogans or pronouncements. So this is a positive choice toward European values. In terms of the Ukrainian government, it is in a difficult economic situation and also political situation. And for them, the best solution would stay where they are, between so to say, East and West, balancing and maybe playing West against Russia and Russia against European Union and trying to extract economic concessions. And this is, it looks like, the game that the government is playing. People on the streets of Kyiv are tired of that game. They want a clear choice and choice toward Europe.
I mean, the implication in, perhaps in what Elisa Rubin said from the streets of Kyiv was that there was pressure, maybe even personal pressure brought to bear on Yanukovych by Vladimir Putin. Does that seem reasonable?
Well, it is quite possible. Again, we don't know what was happening behind the closed doors, what kind of arguments were made. Again, the protests on the streets of Kyiv, an indication that many people in Ukraine are not prepared to tolerate that kind of political deals without consultation with the opposition, with the society at large. But again, at this point, we just don't know what happened.
Gwen Sasse, in the UK, Vladimir Putin appeared very determined here, to say the least. The EU appeared ambivalent. They didn't really make this an easy path, it would appear from the outside, for the Ukraine to come in. Why the coolness from Europe? Do they not care one way or another if Ukraine comes closer to the EU?
I think they do care, but you're pointing out something really important. The relationship between the EU and Ukraine has been hesitant, to say the least, for many years. It's taken a long time to get to this trade and association agreement, and that agreement is not per se a commitment to EU membership for Ukraine.
Right.
It goes further than previous association agreements with other countries have gone, and it's however primarily about access to the internal market, and with a long-term perspective of lifting visa requirements for Ukrainians. But that is very different still from membership, and although there's a line about sharing European values, and that is one of the very vague criteria of the EU for potential membership, but the EU has stayed clear of that and will continue to do so. And I think at the same time, in Ukraine, what the EU exactly means, I think, is still quite vague. And as we've heard in the discussion already, European choice means a whole range of different things. And it goes beyond close relations with the institution, the EU, or the internal market.
We read here people saying the absence of corruption, a strong social safety net, inclusive health care, fair wages, stable currency, responsible government, respect for citizens. I mean, it seems like the, you know, glory road described there.
It's like a long wish list. And I think it's clear that the EU cannot deliver that for Ukraine. It can clearly assist in some ways, but the basic denominator is that there has to be a strong domestic push for some of these reforms.
But if you look at Russia, you can see why Ukrainians might look to the West for that laundry list. That those things do not characterize Russia these days. But still, my question is, why the ambivalence from Europe? Why they don't seem so terribly warm here? Why not?
Because I think they realize they don't have all that much to offer politically to Ukraine at this point. So the EU is, on top of everything else, very busy at the moment with sorting itself out as an institution, its own economies. It has initially even reluctantly enlarged into Central and Eastern Europe, and by now it's quite a big institution already, and there's a few further potential accession states on the list. So it has defined this kind of lighter option for neighboring countries, and Ukraine was always the key country there. Now that seems to have moved on to Moldova, where the deal was signed last week. But politically, the EU doesn't have the means or the political will to get involved in a big way in Ukraine.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the fate of Ukraine this hour, the reach of the West, maybe, Russia's sphere of influence, what Ukrainians want. We're joined by Gwendolyn Zassa from the University of Oxford in England. Serhii Plokhii is with us, professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University, author of Ukraine and Russia and the Origins of the Slavic Nations. Gwen, Serhii, lots of response here. Eva says, the people do want to join the EU, Eva writes, but the country is run, she says, by a small group of oligarchs with strong connections to Russia. It may take a revolution to free themselves from Putin. Jonathan writes, the tension there is a legacy of Stalin's ethnic cleansing in the Ukraine.
But Spiro writes, I believe Russia has reason to be paranoid about the West. It's clear the West strategy is to isolate and neutralize Russia. Let me go to our callers. Alex in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Alex. Thank you for calling. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's a mixed bag of emotions. First of all, extremely proud of the people of Ukraine. It's the people's uprising. They're the ones who came out to the square first.
Are you Ukrainian yourself, Alex?
I am a Ukrainian. I've mm-hmm. lived in America for 11 years, but okay. my whole family is in Ukraine.
Yep.
I'm always in Ukraine in my thoughts.
Okay.
Like I said, there is enormous pride in the people of Ukraine. It is, first of all, the people's uprising. My generation has been waiting for 20 years since the independence days to gain democracy and the rule of law in Ukraine. And the current government is definitely taking us back to the Soviet times, back to Putin's empire. The only concern is the lack of leadership in the opposition. My hope is that the opposition presents a clear program and basically starts a campaign, an election campaign style action to show the alternative, something like the shadow government, to present a clear alternative to the current government.
Are you hopeful, Alex, that Ukraine can work out some kind of middle path here where it gets the values it wants but the relationships that it may need as well?
A lot of it depends on Russia as well. The problem is that we have a very dangerous dictator in Russia who is not willing to compromise. There is no reason why Ukraine cannot be in the European Union and cannot have democracy and close relations with both Russia and the European Union.
Alex, I appreciate your call. One more right here. Andre in Charlotte, North Carolina. Andre, you're on the air.
Yes, I am.
Hi, Andre. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm from Ukraine. I'm from Kharkov region. I'm a city of Kharkov, which is second biggest city in Ukraine. And I wonder why nobody consider people of Eastern Europe who's kind of opposing this European Union association. And we want not just to be the sell to, we need to sell our stuff outside. And I have a big doubt that European want to our stuff, but it's a really big industrial region, and we have lots of customers in Russia, and we kind of wonder what's going to happen to our people work and job. You know, we don't need it. You know, unemployment is already high. We don't want it to be even bigger, and the eastern part of Ukraine is much bigger than western part,
which, and more friendly historically to Russia. So do you oppose the association with the EU, Andre?
It's not quite I oppose it. Mm-hmm. I kind of surprised why people not consider, you know, they cannot see farther than their nose. I mean, if you want to value, yeah, you can have, just don't speed, don't trash around, don't vandalize your elevators, respect your history, respect your country, and you have values. But I wonder, it's all about economics.
Andre, I appreciate your call as well. Serhii, what about the divisions within the Ukraine on this choice? If there is going to be a choice, at least of emphasis or of closeness, is it a regional issue? Is it a political stripe issue?
It is very much a regional issue, and one of the reasons why the current government can kind of ignore the 300,000 strong manifestation in the capital of the country, city of Kyiv, is because they sure that they have support and enough votes, or will have those votes when next elections come to re-elect the current government. And those votes would come, in their opinion, from the east, from eastern Ukraine, which is historically closer to Russia, which has economic ties with Russia. The issue is that when we look at today at TV, when we read newspapers, we hear about quite spontaneous demonstrations in Kyiv. People are mobilized at the situation when the opposition leaders really don't know even where to lead them. When you look at Kharkiv or you look at Donetsk, the manifestations that take place here are maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people, and the accusations are that they were organized by the owners of the enterprises who support the current government, so that people went to the streets there not out of their own will, but because they were coerced by the authorities. And this is a big difference. Economy certainly is very important, and I don't see reason why really Ukraine can't be a member of the association with European Union. This is not even a full membership, and continue good relations with Russia. But certainly Russia and President Putin sees this differently.
Gwen Zasa, we heard earlier in the hour tape from Vladimir Putin saying he sees more here than an honest outpouring of sentiment in the streets, a kind of manipulation in this part of the world. We're well accustomed to agendas behind the stated agenda, power plays and all the rest for a long, long time. How do you see that? Does Moscow have a straightforward, open agenda here that could include Ukraine economically and also make room for the values the people in the streets want? Does the EU have a straightforward and open agenda of fair trade and openness, including to some, you know, trade and association with Russia on the other side?
Yeah, I think it's clear that Russia doesn't have a very open or transparent agenda. On the EU side, it is open and transparent in a sense that it is limited at the moment what is on offer, in particular this economic agreement rather than a political commitment to Ukraine as a as a member. But President Putin clearly uses the rhetoric of external actors manipulating the situation in Ukraine. And we know from 2004 and from a lot of research that has been done on that those demonstrations, as well as what is going on now, there are always, all the time, various actors from both the West and Russia trying to influence things on the ground, but we don't see protests a lot. So it's clearly the domestic element of the frustration of a significant part of the population and then needing a trigger to spell out into protests, into the street, is the key thing here, rather than external actors having stirred this up.
Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I heard that the audio you played of Putin earlier, and to me it sounded more threatening. It sounded like by labeling the protesters extremist groups that he was either justifying violence or paving the way for a violent put-down of the revolution or of any kind of protest. And I see this as kind of like a perverse reaction from the war on terror, where anytime you've got uprising, you just say, hey, terrorist, extremist group, and then you're justified in doing whatever you want. Are your experts afraid of any kind of, violent reaction?
Well, we've already seen over the weekend, for a while there, very brutal suppression of what was going on in parts of the square. Terrorism could be one reference here, but there's also a long history, of course. When Moscow talks about extremism, it traditionally in the Soviet days meant from the capitalist West. Serhii, what about Vladimir Putin and what he's pushing when he speaks about the demonstrations in the streets in such volatile terms, calling them extremists with hidden agendas?
Well, he certainly gives his political support to the current government and to the actions of President Yanukovych and people around him. So certainly this turn in the foreign policy is something that he, of Ukraine's foreign policy, is something that he really welcomes. In terms of the violence and where the violence comes from, it's pretty clear that the opposition and the opposition leaders don't want that. And they were on the streets not only declaring that the protests should be peaceful, but also trying to stop the radicals. There are also accusations made by opposition that the groups that actually bring violence to the street, these are groups that act with the support and with the protection of the government. Again, this is something that certainly should be investigated. But again, the mood on the streets, and I talked to my friends and colleagues in Kyiv who were there on Sunday, is really very peaceful. People come with families, people come with children, people come to demonstrate that actually the turn in the policy is something that they don't welcome.
Gwen Zasa, the U.S. has been working with Russia lately on Syria's chemical weapons, on Iran's nuclear program. They have something at stake there. Maybe not, don't have an interest in getting into a spat with Moscow right now. Russia, does Russia still have naval operations out of Ukraine, Gwen? Is Russia really prepared, willing ultimately to let Ukraine become more deeply enmeshed in the EU? Or is it simply not willing, one way or another, to see that happen?
I think Russia knows that it will always have in the foreseeable future a big stake in Ukraine's economy as well as in its political system. So it doesn't need to consider any extreme measures that some people may think of. So Russia has still its Black Sea fleet positioned in Crimea. That was part of that deal about gas and the stationing of the fleet in Sevastopol in Crimea. But at the same time, that serves as a reminder of Russia's influence. But we shouldn't jump to the conclusion that more extreme, perhaps military measures would be taken. Russia knows it doesn't need to do that. It can repeatedly show its influence, but it doesn't need to resort to those kinds of means.
April's calling from New Orleans. Hi, April. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to have a comment. I was in Ukraine this summer, actually. I was in Odessa, mm-hmm. and it's a charming old Europe-type town, but we went off the path of the tourist areas, went walking around in the city, and it's all towering Soviet-era housing, and, you know, you see a different side of the city, and it just really felt like people want to get out from underneath that. And their neighbors to the west, you have Romania and Hungary and Poland, who are in the EU, also formerly Soviet occupied, are doing so much better than the Ukraine. And it just really seemed that they want to change, and they want something new for the younger generation coming up.
It sounds as though you may be sympathetic to the opposition call in the streets in Kiev this weekend, April.
Yeah, we met a lot of young people, and they were doing Airbnbs in the Ukraine. You know, there's a lot of westernized ideals going on, and they just want something different. And there's not a lot of development. The money doesn't go very far there. And I can see, you know, even next door in Romania, it's much more flourishing. So, yeah, I support them.
April, I appreciate your call. Serhii Plokhii, we've seen Moscow crack down on its own democracy, pro-democracy demonstrations. Realistically, can Vladimir Putin's Russia tolerate a more democratic society in Ukraine, tucked right there under the belly of Russia, a more accountable government in Ukraine that might stand as a kind of rebuke to Russia's own government?
Well, this is certainly one of the arguments that has been made since the time of the Orange Revolution, since 2004. Given the history of the two countries that used to be pretty close for the last 300 plus years, and mentality and so on and so forth, it would be very difficult for proponents of authoritarian regime in Russia to say that, okay, Russia has nothing in the cards but authoritarian rule, if Ukraine would take a more pluralistic pluralistic route in terms of politics, in terms of openness to the world in general, and European Union in particular. So this is certainly a very strong argument and possible explanation of some of the reasons of why Russian government takes the position it takes these days.
Gwen Zasa, could the EU itself take steps that would be likely to lead to some kind of harmony in Ukraine rather than turning it into some kind of battleground state?
They have signaled, first of all, that the violent incidents need to be investigated, and that they've also signaled that negotiations about this association agreement remain open. However, they've also said they don't want to reopen the negotiations as such, but they are ready to pick up again where they left off. So that is, if not a short-term, then a medium-term prospect. And I think in the short term, there will be more contact between the regime in Kiev and the protesters and possibly mediators from the EU, probably from the EU institutions as well as from some of the member states. Some of that has already begun. So if we think that political negotiations might be one way out of the stalemate at the moment, depending, of course, on how large the protests get again and how sustained they can be, then the EU and other actors and also Russian officials will have to be part of that too. There might be, like in 2004, political negotiations coming up with a compromise solution for the moment.
It seems a shame to get back into Cold War postures here. I mean, Moscow could push too hard, but perhaps so could the EU. Could they structure their association differently somehow with Ukraine that would make it more palatable to Russia and still give Ukrainians what they want?
They are unlikely at this point, I think, to reopen negotiations, or they've already excluded the possibility of having three-way negotiations with Russia involved in those negotiations. I think they will play a longer game and see how the political situation unfolds in Ukraine, shaping it perhaps through mediation and then tabling this agreement again. And Yanukovych himself has already signaled that he wants to continue talking about it, so it's not completely out the window.
The United States rather quiet in all this. Does Washington matter in this situation?
It does. And John Kerry was one of the most outspoken by not visiting Kiev and going to Moldova instead. I think that sent a strong signal, and maybe there are more signals to follow. At the end of this week, an OSCE meeting is supposed to take place in Kiev, and then more leaders of various countries will comment on the situation.
Well, we will be watching the streets of Kiev and beyond, a little better informed thanks to the two of you. Gwendolyn Zassa at University of Oxford in the UK, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Serhiy Plokhii, professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard, thank you for joining us, Serhiy.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.